and a good number of them would. Well, we know that New York Times said that half of the children born in Hispanic homes will become in New York City. New York Times said half of the children born in Hispanic New York City homes will have diabetes. That should not surprise us. Close to 70% of Pima Indians in Arizona, New Mexico now have diabetes. So that really shouldn't surprise us. There should be some discourse as we talk about Mayor de Blasio's effort for PK project, which we should support. But there should also be a voice raised that have you considered the consequences if you don't focus really what kind of foods we are going to give this PK in pre-kindergarten, we are going to add more fuel to the fires of diabetes in our city. So why is it that I never hear about any discussion of what should be the menu for these children? We know Bloomberg's this experiment of in the class breakfast. What was that breakfast? I'll tell you what the breakfast was. That's what New York Times told us. Muffin, state sugar. Cereal, state sugar. Milk, state sugar. Orange juice, state sugar. So I think this is where I'm going to end this program. The music tells me I have to take leave. Please join me next week. This has been Science, Health, and Healing. I'm your host, Dr. Majid Ali. Good night.
And Majid Ali will return with Science, Health, and Healing 1 week from today. It is midnight. You're tuned to listener-sponsored, non-commercial, WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM, and streaming live at WBAI.org. It's midnight on a Wednesday, and that means it's time for another episode of Earthwatch with Robert Knight. Coming up at 1:30, Jim Freund with Hour of the Wolf. His special guest, Ken Gale from Ecologic, but talking about comic books this evening, I believe. So don't miss that. Lister at 3. But right now, Robert Knight with Earthwatch.
The bell for freedom still rings. The bell for freedom still rings. Sorrow to me, but does it ring to know the bell of freedom still rings? The hammer for justice still pounds. The hammer for justice still pounds. Heavy is the beating sound of the hammer for justice that pounds. When the will the world stop it listen? When will we all stop and see? He looks upon us with a frown to know that millions of babies still starve. Millions of babies still starve. We can't have the biggest heart if millions of babies still starve. And the innocent ones still die. The innocent ones still die. We can't value life too high if the innocent ones still die. When will the world stop enlisting? When will we all stop and see? When will we find what we've been missing? That the man in the moon must have found. 'Cause he looks upon us with a frown. Light of truth we won't let shine. Light of truth we won't let shine. Tell me, has the world gone blind? Light of truth we won't let shine. As long as there's life, there's still a day. As long as there's life, there's still a day. And I know that we can find our way. For as long as there's life, there's still a day.
This is Earthwatch on WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. The dates of April 4th and 5th, especially on this anniversary, on the 4th and 5th of April 1968, are key to the tragic and racist social history of the United States as a shocked nation awoke to the pain and violence of the overnight assassination of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. It was at 6:01 p.m. on the 4th of April, 68, at the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, where a fatal rifle shot hit King as he stood on a second-floor balcony, with the bullet entering his right cheek, smashing his jaw, and traveling down his spinal cord and lodging finally in his shoulder. It was a fatal shot. Early national media reports of the incident were spotty, but by the late evening, spontaneous urban insurrections had begun in scores of American cities, including Washington, New York, Chicago, Baltimore, Louisville, Kansas City, and dozens more. One of the most poignant announcements of these breaking events surrounding the King assassination came in an impromptu speech by the former Attorney General and New York Senator and contemporaneous presidential candidate Robert Bobby Kennedy, who broke the news to supporters while en route to an Indianapolis campaign rally.
Could you lower those signs, please? I have some very sad news for all of you, and that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis. Martin Luther King dedicated his life to love and to justice between fellow human beings. He died in the cause of that effort. In this difficult day, in this difficult time for the United States, it's perhaps well to ask what kind of a nation we are and what direction we want to move in. For those of you who are black, considering the evidence evidently is that there were white people who were responsible, you can be filled with bitterness and with hatred and a desire for revenge. We can move in that direction as a country in greater polarization, black people amongst blacks and white amongst whites, filled with hatred toward one another. Or we can make an effort, as Martin Luther King did, to understand and to comprehend and replace that violence, that stain of bloodshed that is spread across our land, with an effort to understand, compassion, and love. For those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. But we have to make an effort in the United States. We have to make an effort to understand, to get beyond or go beyond these rather difficult times. My favorite poem, my favorite poet was Aeschylus. He once wrote, "Even in our sleep, pain which cannot forget falls drop by drop upon the heart, until in our own day despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God." What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black.
The late Senator, presidential candidate, and former Attorney General, and cognomen of the bridge in New York City that used to be known as the Triborough, the late Robert Bobby Kennedy. That was his spontaneous speech on the night of the assassination of Martin Luther King, April 4th, 1968. Less than 24 hours later, Kennedy reflected even more deeply on the nature of American violence the following day, April 5th, 1968, when he addressed the City Club of Cleveland.
It is not a day for politics. I have saved this one opportunity, my only event of today, to speak briefly to you about the mindless menace of violence in America, which again stains our land and every one of our lives. It is not the concern of any one race. The victims of the violence are black and white, rich and poor, young and old, famous and unknown. They are most important of all, human beings whom other human beings loved and needed. No one, no matter where he lives or what he does, can be certain who next will suffer from some senseless act of bloodshed. And yet it goes on and on and on in this country of ours. Why? What has violence ever accomplished? What has it ever created? No martyr's cause has ever been stilled by an assassin's bullet. No wrongs have ever been righted by riots and civil disorders. A sniper is only a coward, not a hero. And an uncontrolled or uncontrollable mob is only the voice of madness, not the voice of the people. Whenever any American's life is taken by another American unnecessarily, whether it is done in the name of the law or in defiance of the law, by one man or by a gang, in cold blood or in passion, in an attack of violence or in response to violence, whenever we tear at the fabric of our lives, which another man has painfully and clumsily woven for himself and his children. Whenever we do this, then the whole nation is degraded. Among free men, said Abraham Lincoln, there can be no successful appeal from the ballot to the bullet. And those who take such appeal are sure to lose their case and pay the cost. Yet we seemingly tolerate a rising level of violence that ignores our common humanity and our claims to civilization alike. We calmly accept newspaper reports of civilian slaughter in far-off lands. We glorify killing on movie and television screens, and we call it entertainment. We'd make it easier for men of all shades of sanity to acquire weapons and ammunition that they desire. Too often we honor swagger and bluster and the wielders of force. Too often we excuse those who are willing to build their own lives on the shattered dreams of other human beings. Some Americans who preach nonviolence abroad fail to practice it here at home. Some accuse others of rioting and inciting riots, have by their own conduct invited them. Some look for scapegoats. Others look for conspiracies. But this much is clear. Violence breeds violence. Repression breeds retaliation. And only a cleansing of our whole society can remove this sickness from our souls. For there is another kind of violence, slower, but just as deadly destructive as the shot or the bomb in the night. This is the violence of institutions, indifference, inaction, and decay. This is the violence that afflicts the poor, that poisons relations between men because their skin has different colors. This is the slow destruction of a child by hunger and schools without books and homes without heat in the winter. This is the breaking of a man's spirit by denying him the chance to stand as a father and as a man amongst other men. And this too afflicts us all. For when you teach a man to hate and to fear his brother, when you teach that he is a lesser man because of his color or his beliefs or the policies that he pursues, when you teach that those who differ from you threaten your freedom or your job or your home or your family, then you also learn to confront others, not as fellow citizens, but as enemies, to be met not with cooperation, but with conquest, to be subjugated and to be mastered. We learn at the last to look at our brothers as alien men with whom we share a city, but not a community, men bound to us in common dwelling, but not in a common effort. We learn to share only a common fear, only a common desire to retreat from each other, only a common impulse to meet disagreement with force. For all this, there are no final answers for those of us who are American citizens. Yet we know what we must do, and that is to achieve true justice among all of our fellow citizens. The question is not what programs we should seek to enact. The question is whether we can find in our own midst and in our own hearts that leadership of humane purpose that will recognize the terrible truths of our existence. We must admit the vanity of our false distinctions, the false distinctions among men, and learn to find our own advancement in search for the advancement of all. We must admit to ourselves that our children's future cannot be built on the misfortune of another's. We must recognize that this short life can neither be ennobled or enriched by hatred or by revenge. Our lives on this planet are too short. The work to be done is too great to let this spirit flourish any longer in this land of ours. Of course, we cannot banish it with a program nor with a resolution, but we can perhaps remember, if only for a time, that those who live with us are our brothers, that they share with us the same short moment of life, that they seek, as do we, nothing but the chance to live out their lives in purpose and in happiness, winning what satisfaction and fulfillment that they can. Surely this bond of common fate, surely this bond of common goals can begin to teach us something. Surely we can learn at the least to look around at those of us, of our fellow men, and surely we can begin to work a little harder to bind up the wounds among us and to become in our hearts brothers and countrymen once again. Tennyson wrote in Ulysses, "That which we are, one equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield."
Bobby Kennedy speaking to the Cleveland City Club 44 years ago exactly, on the occasion of the 5th of April, 1968. Exactly 2 months and 2 days after that, RFK would meet the same violent gunshot death as Martin Luther King on the 6th of June, 1968, in a Los Angeles hotel, presidential campaign stuff.
Senator, how are you going to counter Mr. Humphreys and his backgrounding you as far as the delegate votes go?
You think you're so back to struggle for it?
Somebody said, Robert...
Oh my God. Senator Kennedy has been shot in the head. I am right here. Rayford Johnson has a hold of a man who apparently has fired the shot. He has fired the shot. He still has the gun. The gun is pointed at me at this moment. I hope they can get the gun out of his hand. Be very careful. Get the gun. Get the gun.
Get the gun.
Stay away from the gun.
Get the gun.
Stay away from the gun. His hand is frozen. Get his thumb. Get his thumb. Get his thumb. Take a hold of his thumb and break it if you have to. Get his thumb. Okay, now hold on to the guy. Hold on to him. Hold on to him, ladies and gentlemen. They have the gun away from the man. In this shot. They've got the gun. I can't see the man.
The assassination of Robert Kennedy on the 6th of June, 1968. In response to the assassination of Martin Luther King on the 4th of April, 1968, there was the next day a season of urban insurrections in scores of cities across the United States. And meanwhile, in New York City, less than 24 hours after King's killing, as much of America was burning, there was a rally for King in New York City's Central Park. That rally included such speakers as Dr. Benjamin Spock, Ossie Davis, James Forman, Flo Kennedy, and many others. It was originally broadcast live on Pacifica radio station WBAI, and we now hear some of the proceedings of that day. The attendees understandably had high passion and mixed emotion, and we'll hear how some of that rally unfolded.
My name is Lydia Williams. I'm from the Black Caucus. I'm also with Freedom and Peace Party. Do we know what we're out here for today? All right, let's prove it. Before I start, I want a moment of silence. I'm calling for a moment of complete silence. I want a moment of complete silence in the memory of Martin Luther King. I want a moment of complete silence in front and in back. You're supposed to be out here in the memory of a great black man that got killed by white racism, and I want a moment of complete silence. Thank you. It was hard to come by. Now let's get together here and get some facts straight. It's high time that things were made plain. Last night something was proved. In Chicago, when the Black Caucus was formed, we made a 13-point resolution. One of them called for a white civilizing committee. People looked at us like we were out of our minds. They didn't know what we were talking about, because we were the barbarians. We were uncivilized. Well, last night you found out what I meant by a white civilizing committee. Last night, the white man's best friend was killed. His head was blown off by a white man. This is why you need to civilize the white community. We have practiced for years being nonviolent. We have practiced turning the other cheeks. We have become masters of turning the other cheek. And while Martin Luther King had his head turned, and his other cheek up, somebody got him. So where does this leave us? I'm not sure. There's some hole cards to be played. I don't know what they are, and I'm not about to discuss them down here in Central Park Mall. Y'all gathered out here today to hear a whole lot of speeches. But for the blacks in the audience, I hope you know where it's at. I do, and I hope all of you do too. For the whites in the audience, I hope they know where it's at. And I hope last night came as education, that the racists in this country can stop sitting on their backsides acting like they're all innocent, because the guilt didn't come from the man that shot the gun alone. It came from the ones that sat back and said, not I. I wouldn't do that. My friends won't do that. Some of my best friends are niggas. All that rhetoric sounds great, but the only best friend I got is a black man, and some of them I ain't trusting too far. Last night there was a lot of discussion on TV on who's going to take over now. Who's going to lead the nonviolent movement now? It sounded great. It went on till 2 o'clock in the morning. It was wonderful. Why should we keep producing leaders for white America to blow them down? We don't need the leader. It's the people's fight now. Black America doesn't have a problem. We solved our problem. The few of us that were hanging out on the periphery that didn't know they had a problem and thought they had made it in the white man's country came found out last night when their Jesus got shot down that they ain't got it made. And it's time for all of them to come home. But now white America has the problem and they better hurry up about solving it. Southern Christian leadership called for the flag to be hung upside down because a disaster happened last night. I see them hanging at half-mast. That's great. But when white America discovers the disaster it performed last night, they'll turn them upside down in a hurry. I'm also appealing to my black brothers and sisters that's here today to be cool. Be cool. I think all of you know what I mean. Be cool. I didn't say a word. You're downtown. You know where you are. Look around you. The man is ready. You needn't think because you're an integrated crowd that it'll be any safer because the whites out here are considered white liberals and they're considered expandable. And if the man wants you, baby, he'll take them to get you. He can afford it. He's in a majority anyhow. He can afford these whites that's out here if it means taking them to get you. So just keep a cool head, you know. Get yourself together, and if you got something to do, do it right. This time, I'd like to introduce someone to you who's a good friend of mine and who's a great worker, a beautiful black woman who's done a lot of work. She's worked around Rap Brown and a few other of our fallen heroes at the moment. Flo Kennedy. Okay.
All right. They got the last of the good ones.
Yeah.
Hey. That was the last of the good ones. That was the last of the good ones. Now it's up to us. Now it's the time for the hymn singing. They're going to try to pull a Jack Kennedy. You know, everybody's sorry. Everybody loved Martin Luther King. That's why they let him go to jail. Everybody loved him. That's why you didn't hear a peep when they got an injunction against him for a peaceful march, the poor soul. Everybody loved him. That's why the Ku Klux Klan had to prevail on Johnson to call leaders of what? Leaders of the prostitution of your rights. And they're entitled to prostitute your rights because you don't do a damn thing to get them. But that was the last of the good ones. And I'm sorry about that. Richie Havens is here. I'm going to pray.
There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's so much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, proud men dig my earth. None of them along the line what any of it is worth. No, no. No need to get excited, said the Joker. He finally spoke. There's too many among us that think that life is but a joke. And I, we've been through that. This is not our fate. Let us not speak falsely now. The hour is getting late, 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 late. watchtower. The princess kept the view. Other women came and went, barefoot servants too. Hey, outside in the distance, a wildcat did growl. Two riders came approaching. The wind began to howl. Yeah, 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 yeah. But remember, it's all along the watchtower. All along the watchtower. All along the watchtower. All along the watchtower.
Haven. Richie Haven.
At this time, I'd like to introduce to you Mr. John McTyner, National Director of the Du Bois Clubs.
Hear, hear.
America has lost a real leader. The world has lost a real leader. In this struggle to change this world, to change America, a whole lot of leaders may go down. A whole lot of us may go down. But I don't know how everybody else feels, but when I decided to get myself in this struggle, I said at that point, God damn it, give me freedom or give me death, God damn it. And I'm ready to give my life if that's what's necessary to change this goddamn situation in this country.
Yeah.
And I think we got a crisis in this country. I think we got a situation here. And I think the answers in the thousands of people that are standing out here today, we got the answer. The answer, God damn it, is struggle. The answer is fight. The answer is stand up, be proud, be black, but fight. Now I think everybody gathered here today wants to do something. They want to feel their power. They want to express themselves. I think we ought to leave here today, and I think we ought to go down and confront Mayor Lindsay. It is that bastard that's called for tanks in Harlem. He's got a nerve to pretend to be the freedom, to be a friend of black people in this country, and at the same time, he's signing their death warrant. With all these repressive laws he's passed, with the millions of dollars he's spending on tanks and guns, I say we march from here, through Times Square, down to City Hall and confront him. I'm going to talk a little bit about lynching Bird Johnson. That racist fascist had a nerve to stand up and use Dr. King's distorted image and use him for his own gain. He's supposed to be against blind violence. What the hell are they doing in Vietnam?
Go, brother.
He's supposed to be against blind violence. What the hell are they doing with the National Guard, with the riot guns, with the billions of dollars they're spending to kill black people? I think we got to tell it like it is. America is a violent country. Let's tell it like it is. Now, the LBJ said in the State of the Union message, we're going to start a war on crime. That meant war on black people, let's face it. He said, we won't tolerate violence. Violence won't bring progress. That meant black people stay in your place, goddammit, because we're going to kill you. That's what that meant. And when he said that, listen now, when he said that, he gave a license to that fascist maniac who killed Dr. King. The blood is on LBJ's hands. Yes, that's what I'm saying. Today, we need the most massive kind of struggle that we could ever muster. I think that's what Dr. King stood for, and I think that's why he was killed. Because he called the millions together. Because he rallied the millions to struggle. His poor people's thing in Washington was to bring the millions together, to express their opposition to this war, to express their need for jobs and against oppression and poverty. And I think that's the kind of direction America needs now. Now's the time to end repression. Now's the time for 2 billion jobs this summer. 2 million jobs for the unemployed black and white. That's what we need now. Not a penny more for oppression. Not a penny more.
Right about now, we would like to introduce a man who is supposed to run with Dr. Martin Luther King as vice president on the freedom ticket in California. He is a foremost authority on helping people evade the draft. He has been arrested many times for helping us, the brothers and sisters. I want to give to you now none other than Dr. Spock.
I had great respect for Dr. King, and I had great love for Dr. King.
Quiet!
Dr. King.
Where's the buckley? Where's that buckley? Back
there. Brothers, sisters, and friends. Now, brothers, sisters, and friends, I know the mood is hot, and I know how you feel. I was out there last night, too, and I was feeling pretty bad. But when Flo Kennedy told you about some of your white allies who have done things like help raise bail for people like Rap Brown, when some of us weren't able to contribute as well as we could, and things like this, and some of our black brothers got in trouble with the draft, and some of us either couldn't help them or didn't know how to help them or didn't have the means, there were people who were willing to help them. And I think at a time like this, in the memory of Martin Luther King, the least we can do, I mean, there's enough white racists out there for you to take everything out on. There's enough of them. But if you look around this park and you realize how many millions of people there are in America, you know they ain't all here. So there's a hell of a lot of them left over for you. But at this time, I sincerely beg and beseech you, please, let Dr. Benjamin Spock get a word in edgewise. I thank you one and all. And now I will present to you, and I would like a little bit of, you know what it is, what I'm talking about, Dr. Benjamin Spock.
I'm impressed that a woman can do so much easier than a man what was just done silencing this crowd. I said before, I had enormous respect for Dr. King, and I came to love Dr. King. And I also want to say that I love Mrs. King, too, and let's remember her today and all write a letter to her, a most inspiring woman and a good mother. What I want to say now is particularly to the white people in the audience here. The President's Commission on Civil Disorders came in with a pretty good report, much more honest than most reports of its kind. What has been the effect? Generally speaking, it has been greeted with a significant silence. The President hasn't even had the courage to say that he supported it. He only said that he recommended that people read it and study it. Richard Nixon characteristically came out more flat-footedly. He said that it didn't put enough emphasis on oppression in the streets, and we know where he stands. There is an enormous job to be done to get racial justice in the United States. Even if all of us start with all the enthusiasm and strength that we have, it still is going to take one decade, two decades, three decades to really get justice in this country. But it's time for us to start. Dr. King stood not just for nonviolence. Dr. King stood for militancy. And there is, the white people will do no honor to Dr. King if they just say, too bad, he was a wonderful man. The only meaning that we can take from his death is to rededicate ourselves to become militant in trying to get racial justice in this country.
Can I have a hand with Dr. Spock? Thank you. And now, Richard Tucson.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You people out there in the audience, you don't know me. And I'm not trying to become Stokely Carmichael on H-Rat Brown or Malcolm X. I'm telling you, I'm a black individual telling you that we're in a racist country and something is going to have to be done about it. You understand? I'm telling you again that somebody wants you to walk up on 42nd Street and burn down movie theaters when I'm trying to tell you to go down to Wall Street and get to the system that we are all crippled under. It's because of the capitalist system that we got my black brothers and sisters down in Mississippi starving, and we got black brothers and sisters up there in New York State starving. You got poor Kentucky whites starving, and y'all gonna say, march on 42nd Street. It's right here in the United States of America where you gotta become, right here, you gotta start thinking, what's happening to you? Why we got poor schools uptown? The problem has to be dealt with. You understand? I don't want to burn down America. I dig the place. But they don't dig me. They don't dig me. They don't dig me. They don't dig me. I went up Sunday. Sunday. Now, if you don't believe me, if you have any students here from NYU, you go up to NYU Hall of Fame, and there wasn't one black bus up there, one black statue of no black man. Not one. And they got room for one up there now. And before I die, I bet your king is going to be up there. That's it. King is going to be up there. I say it again. You don't know me. It's the first time I spoke to so many people in all my life. And I'm telling you, you got to become realistic. I'm black, brother. I was there last night when they broke in the liquor stores. Believe it or not, I ain't lying. For the first time, I had to let some depression loose. You see, when the riots broke out in Detroit, they told you about the cops they had in the riot district. Well, Lord knows they didn't tell you about the son of a guns surrounding General Motors. They didn't tell you that. They gonna keep the General Motors and Dow Chemical Company. They gonna surround all these things, you see? Because they don't want you to get to them. But this is the power structure right now that's laughing at. I don't know how many of us in here, 8 million, 2 million, they laughing at us because they say, these people ain't going to do nothing. They going to rap all their life. They ain't going to do nothing. But I'm telling you, time has to come now. If a man feel like he's ready to die, and I'm ready to die, something's going to have to go something. I'm telling you, let me tell you, United States of America, like Malcolm made a statement, the chicken has come on the roost one time. And he meant, if they kill President Kennedy, you know, they don't take twice about killing you. And we seen that. We seen that in Birmingham, Alabama. Four little innocent girls, children. Ain't nothing been done about it. Chicken heart say, right? Right? You know what I'm saying? Again, the same. Here's a man, Martin Luther King, who preached nonviolence, who was a Baptist preacher. A Baptist preacher on the white Protestant Anglo-Saxon beliefs who preached nonviolence, and what happened? He died on that platform. He died on that platform. Here's Malcolm at the end. He gets killed when he decides that what we should do in America is put the United States on trial so Charles Irving Arnold and his boys code for CIA. Charles Irving Arnold, they had him blasted away. They had him blasted away. You understand? So I'm telling you now, either do two things. Either go downtown, do something with Wall Street, or put this goddamn country on trial because it should be on trial. Yeah. Yeah.
Wall Street, hmm? We have been listening to an anniversary retrospective of the events surrounding the death of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, his assassination in Memphis on the 4th of April, 1968, and the ensuing events, including two remarkable presentations by the late, also assassinated, Senator and former Attorney General Robert Bobby Kennedy. And the portion that we just heard were actualities of the anniversary of the April 5th gathering in Central Park in response to the assassination of Dr. King in the midst of a nationwide outbreak of urban insurrections. Sometimes they're called by some people riots, but there was a great consternation across the nation at that time. And these actualities that you've just heard were originally broadcast live on Pacifica Station, WBAI, and produced by David Rapkin and the team of producers that covered the event that day. I'm Robert Knight in New York.
Dr. King is introduced by the author, James Baldwin.
The man who we are here to talk to, who will talk to us, that is Martin Luther King. I think it's very important to remember that this moment in 1968 is a kind of culmination of things that began in this country quite a long time ago, and specifically speaking, 1954, with a Supreme Court decision outlawing segregation in the schools, and in 1957, when Martin was thrown that ball in Montgomery, Alabama, when Rosa Parks refused to stand up because her feet hurt. Now, we watched in this 11 years, in this 13 years, depending on the point of view, in this country, a terrible dissent. What Rosa Parks was saying in Montgomery in 1956, and what those Negroes were saying when they were marched for 389 days, the country did not want to hear and did not hear. And as time rolled on, and kids, including people like Stokely Carmichael, were being beaten with chains, thrown into jail, marching up and down those dusty highways, trying to change the conscience of this country. Still nobody heard, and nobody really cared. And poor Martin spent most of his time in and out of jail, as all of us know, trying to redeem what we claim we live by, the principle of love your neighbor, the principle of if it happens to you, it's happening to me. the principle John Donne talked about, you know, when he said that any man's death diminishes me. But in this country, race and Christianity and power are so tied together in self-interest, what one takes is self-interest, that no one heard it. It's only now that people are beginning to suspect that something terrifying has happened, and with our consent, because we do know that we cannot fight a civil war, which is what this ferment is about, because I am your brother. I was born here. My father's and my father's blood is in this soil, and nothing will drive me from this country. It also belongs to me. You cannot fight a civil war and a global war, too, at the same time. And especially if both are predicated on the same principle. And I'm not now accusing the Americans of being wicked. I'm accusing us of having allowed ourselves to be brainwashed into a state of ignorance which allows us to forget that the peasant in Saigon and the peasant in Detroit are the same people. And what we don't know about the peasant in Saigon is what we don't know about Sambo here. And that has destroyed the American sense of reality. And I suppose what we're here to do tonight is begin to correct that. Are people who can believe that I was happy on the levee picking cotton, or happy in the mines digging coal, and giving all this away to other people for their wealth, and unable to protect my house, my woman, my children? Are people who can believe that I did this out of love for other people, and that I was happy doing it, and that all those songs and dances I learned while I was doing it meant that I was happy, can believe anything? And I'm afraid that the people who claim to represent us in Washington these days, from the president on down, do believe that, and do believe, as they believed so long, that they have the right to tell me how to live, and are unable to begin to suspect that other people, Sambo, for example, can teach us a great deal about how to live. That's all I have to say, really. Thank you.
Thank you very kindly for your heartwarming applause. Now, I'm going to try to be very brief, and I can assure you that brevity is a magnificent accomplishment for the Baptist preacher. And since I have two sermons to preach in Los Angeles tomorrow morning, I can assure you that I'll hold the lengthy message until that time. But I do want to thank you for your presence, and I think your presence is indicative of the fact that you are concerned about the great problems that we face in our nation and all over the world. We have just heard from Marlon Brando that these are confusing times. And I don't think anyone would disagree with that. We are faced with a situation where we find restlessness among the poor and discontent among the affluent. And for some reason, it seems that this mammoth ship of state is not moving toward new and more secure shores, but toward old destructive rocks. It seems somehow that things are mixed up in our country. We have confused policies, confused priorities, and indeed confused purposes. I remember so well that President Johnson raised a question some weeks ago when he was giving his State of the Union address. He talked of all of the beautiful television sets that we have over the nation, In fact, he gave the number, about 70 or 80 million. He talked about the beautiful automobiles and the massive expressways that will hold our automobiles up and keep them flowing. He talked about the number of automobiles, new automobiles, that come out every year. And he said after that, yet that is questioning in the land. That is a strange restlessness. And I guess he raised the question because he didn't quite know what was wrong. Well, there is something radically wrong. And I suspect it is that in all too many instances, we have allowed the means by which we live to outdistance the ends for which we live. We have maximized the minimum and minimized the maximum. And so we've ended up with guided missiles and misguided men. And I guess that's the basis of the questioning and the restlessness facing this generation. Our nation is in a mess. The world is in a mess. Now the question is, what do we do? And I must confess that I have no pretense to omniscience. I don't know everything, and the answers are hard to find today because of the great ambiguities of life and history. But we have to do something. Marlon Brando also mentioned the riot report, the Kerner report, that came out a few days ago. And it said some things to us that we cannot ignore. Some of us have been saying these things all along, but nobody paid much attention to them. Now, maybe after they have now been said by a presidential commission, and now that these things have the halo of respectability about them, maybe some people will listen. But in gloomy and realistic terms, that report pointed out that our nation is moving toward two societies, one white and one black, separate and unequal. And the fact is that with this kind of move taking place, hatreds are deeper, tensions are greater, misunderstanding will be wider. But the commission report didn't stop that. It brought out another thing that is often painful to hear, and yet it must be heard if the problems that we face in our nation are to be solved. And that is the fact that racism is still at the center of our nation. We must honestly face the fact that America is a racist society. And we must see racism for what it is. It is a myth of an inferior people. It is a tragic notion that one group has all of the worth and all of the knowledge, all of the significance, all of the purity. And another group has all of the inferiority, the worthlessness, and the impurity. And whenever racism is a basic philosophy, whether it is expressed overtly or whether it is subconsciously or latently held, it always brings into being an absolute disrespect for human personality. Now, the first thing that must be on the agenda of our nation is to get rid of racism in all of its dimensions. And it means that white America will have to do something positively, affirmatively, and meaningfully in order to bring all of God's children into the mainstream of the life of this nation. It cannot be done short of something massive. And it means that those who have not known the pathology of the ghetto will have to somehow take that empathetic journey and join hands with those who have been denied and who have been hurt and who have been exploited for so many years. Massive programs are needed, and that means billions of dollars. And the question is whether the affluent part of America is willing to make the sacrifice so that everybody will be able to live a creative life. I was saying earlier this afternoon to a group that sometimes the bootstrap philosophy can be exaggerated. Certainly, people should try desperately to lift themselves by their own bootstraps. But we must always understand that this cannot be an absolutistic philosophy. There's only so much that anybody can do. I was on a plane the other day, and a man started talking with me, and he said, the thing about your people is that they don't do anything for themselves. And he went on to say that all of the other ethnic groups have come to America, and they face problems just like your people, and yet they lifted themselves by their own bootstraps. And I looked at him and tried to talk with him in understanding terms, and I said, you know, it doesn't help the Negro for insensitive, unfeeling white people to say that other ethnic groups who have been in this country 100 or 150 years and who came voluntarily have gotten ahead of him, and he's been here almost 350 years and he was brought here involuntarily in chains. And I went on to say to him that no other ethnic group has been a slave on American soil. And then I went on to bring out to him that the nation made the black man's color a stigma. And the fact is that when his color was made a stigma, that brought about a great sense of depression. There was no way to change it. And even linguistics and semantics conspired to make the Negro feel that he was nobody. If you open Roget's Thesaurus, you will find there some 120 synonyms for black. And virtually all of them represent something low, degrading, nasty, smut, dirty. You'll find about 130 synonyms for white. Almost everyone represents something high, pure, chaste, noble. And in a real sense, our children have so often been taught day in and day out 120 ways to feel that they are inferior, and whites have been taught 130 ways to feel that they are superior. And so white lie in our society is a little better than a black lie. If somebody goes wrong in the family, we don't call them a white sheep, we call them a black sheep. If we get mixed up in other ways with the law, we don't call it white male, we call it black male. We don't whiteball people, we blackball them. Now, this sounds a bit humorous, but it is true, and one can see what happened after generations of oppression and denial. and a feeling that was developed because the color was made a stigma, that you are nobody. And so many Negro boys and girls grew up feeling this, that they didn't have any dignity and any worth. I went out a few months ago to a program where my son and daughter were appearing. They are attending an integrated school in Atlanta, and they were the first Negro kids to go to this particular school. And they had a program that night entitled Music That Made America Great. And both my son, my oldest son, my oldest daughter were in there. In the choir, and they were singing the music that made America great. And I listened to the music, and they had the music of various ethnic groups, beautiful music. And then I was waiting to hear some other music that I knew was great, the most original music on American soil, some of the most beautiful music that has ever come forth. Sometimes it emerges in sorrow songs, but it has some gentle sighings and glad thunders at times that can touch the soul, and it gave people hope. It lifted them. Great music. And I waited for it. And I never will forget that that concert came to an end, and there was not the singing of one Negro spiritual, or none of the music that has come into being out of the black people and out of the suffering and the agony of the black people of this country. Instead of that, the program ended with the singing of Dixie. And I looked at my son and my daughter having to end the program singing Dixie, the music that made America great. And I sat there and all but wept within. And I said to myself, how can they ever feel that they are somebody if they feel that they have no heritage, if they feel that they've done nothing or given nothing to the life of the world and to history? And how can these white students ever get rid of their prejudices and their feelings of inferiority or superiority until they know these things? And somehow we will never have an integrated society until we see these things. Until we come to see that integration is not a problem, but an opportunity to participate in the beauty of diversity. And these things don't always get across. I was trying in my little way to get this over to that man who didn't understand this. And I had to finally tell him another thing that is often overlooked. I had to say to him that nobody, no group has totally lifted itself by its own bootstraps. I reminded him of the fact that in 1863 a document was signed by Abraham Lincoln, which was to free the Negro from the bondage of physical slavery, but it didn't give him any land to make that freedom meaningful. You know, it was something like keeping a man in prison for many, many years and suddenly discovering that he is not guilty of the crime for which he was convicted, and then just going up to him saying, now you are free. But you don't give him any bus fare to get to town. You don't give him any money to get any clothes to put on his back, nothing to get on his feet in life again. Every code of jurisprudence would rise up against this. But yet this is exactly what America did to the black man. It simply said, you are free. And by the thousands and millions, 4 million to be exact, they stood there penniless, illiterate, not knowing where to go and what to do. And the irony of it all is that at that same time, through an act of Congress, our government was giving away millions of acres of land in the West and the Midwest, which meant that it was willing to undergird its white peasants from Europe with an economic floor. But not only did it give the land, it built land-grant colleges to teach them how to farm. It provided county agents to further their expertise in farming. It provided later on low interest rates so that they could mechanize their farms. And today, millions of these people, thousands of them at least, are being paid millions of dollars a year in federal subsidies not to farm. Senator Eastland, whom you may know, gets about $125,000 a year not to farm on various sections of his plantation in Mississippi. And yet these are the very people who tell the black people of America that they must lift themselves by their own bootstraps. Somewhere we must come to see that there is a massive job to be done, and it cannot be done without massive concern and without an understanding that that is a great deal of repentance that must take place. Now, we in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference are still trying. The job is often difficult, and I can say to you that it is terribly frustrating. Often we all feel that we are struggling in a situation where the problem is basically insoluble. And yet, in order to live, you've got to maintain hope. You've got to go on in spite of. You've got to have that something that the existential philosophers call the courage to be. And so we're trying to go on in spite of. And as we go on, we need the support of all people of goodwill. The problem can only be solved when there is a kind of coalition of conscience. Now, I'm not sure if we have that many consciences left. Too many have gone to sleep. But there are some left. And we've got to be that something that Arnold Toynbee, the historian, refers to as a creative minority, ready to do battle for the sacred, vital, valid issues of life, ready to do battle for the principles of justice and goodwill and peace and brotherhood. There are a lot of poor people in our nation. We've seen them in various ways, but so often we don't allow ourselves to see them. And therefore they become invisible. The invisible poor. I would not fool you when I say that I've been in the Delta of Mississippi. And I've been in the little shacks of people who earn less than $400 a year. I wouldn't be fooling you if I told you that I've been through the slums of Chicago. I lived in one. I've been through the slums of Cleveland. I lived there for about 6 months last year. And I would not be telling you an untruth. And I say to you that I've seen young Negro men and women not earning enough money, and their parents not earning enough money to begin to function in the mainstream of life. I've seen the lead poisoning in their houses. I've seen the rats and I've seen the roaches. I've seen them because they didn't get much sleep that night. They had to stay awake to keep the rats away from their children. I've seen these things with my own eyes. And sometimes out of despair, out of agony and out of the ache and anguish of their daily lives, they try to forget it all and they try to escape. Sometimes they turn out of humiliation to dope addiction, alcoholism, not wanting to face it. Sometimes a father will end up leaving his family because the welfare law says that a family can't get welfare if there's an able-bodied man in the house, and here he is unemployed, not able to get a job, but he's in the house. And so for humanitarian reasons, he ends up deserting the family so that the children can get something to eat I've seen these things happen. Now the job facing the nation today is to get rid of poverty. We are the richest nation in the history of the world. Our national gross product this year is about $800 billion. That is what it is, the richest nation in the history of the world. It wouldn't take much to do what I'm talking about. It wouldn't take a great percentage of that national gross product to do what I'm talking about. If the haves are willing to somehow join hands with the have-nots and armed with compassionate traveler's checks, journey into that other country of their brother's hurt and denial and neglect, it wouldn't take that much. We've done it before. We talk in Congress about rewarding the rioters. And I've heard congressmen standing up saying they aren't going to reward the rioters. And I think of the fact that we developed a Marshall Plan after Hitler had destroyed a great deal of Europe. We built it back up. We built a great deal of Germany back up. And nobody said you are rewarding the Nazis. And that is something shameful about a nation with people who have lived in it all of these years. Because in anger and in moments of understandable bitterness, they exploded into violence, and the only response is to call for a day of prayer and the appointment of a commission, and then the president won't even say a kind word about his own commission's report. It is time now for something positive to take place. And this is why we're going to have a campaign in Washington. This is why we're going with poor people. I don't know what we'll be able to do in Washington. Frankly, I know we've got to do something. I know we've got to take the inchoate rage of the ghetto and transform it into a constructive and creative force. It is not enough for an oppressed people to be angry, because anger is not a program. It is necessary to unite and organize so that that anger can be transformed into a creative and constructive force. And this is what we are trying to do. And our Poor People's Campaign in Washington, taking the power of direct action, keeping this issue before the attention of the nation, and developing a movement that is dramatic and attention-getting, so that for at least 60 days, nobody in this country can overlook the fact that there are poor people around. And we solicit your support as we go to Washington, not to beg, but to demand jobs or income now. Now, there's one other thing. One other thing that I'd like to say, and that is, we can't have a campaign like this in Washington without recognizing the fact that as long as a war in Vietnam is taking place, we cannot seriously address ourselves to the great problems, and the blight, and the despair, the slum conditions of our cities. And that this is why I have been determined to keep these two issues together. There comes a time when silence is betrayal. And I had watched that war in Vietnam, and I came to see that I could no longer be silent about it. And our nation is committing a grave crime, and I'm convinced if we, the people of goodwill, don't unite and keep the pressure on, and demand an end to that war in Vietnam, that the curtain of doom may well come down on American civilization. The soul of our nation is being lost. Our image is terribly scarred. We are morally and politically isolated all over the world. And there isn't a single ally, former ally, in terms of a major nation in the world that would dare send a troop to Vietnam. Not only are we morally and politically isolated in the world, we are playing havoc with our domestic destinies. Not only that, we are saying to the world that we are a terribly arrogant nation. Senator Fulbright calls it the arrogance of power. And we are arrogant in feeling that we have everything to teach every other nation and nothing to learn about them and learn from them. We are arrogant in feeling that we are fighting for the rights, in quotes, of another people, and we won't put our own house in order. We are arrogant in sending young black men and white men to fight in brutal solidarity on the battlefields of Vietnam. And yet when they come back home, it is doubtful that they'll be able to live together on the same block. These are the facts of life. But not only that, the longer we stay in the war in Vietnam, the closer and closer we push the whole human race to destruction. So we must oppose this war. We must oppose it because it's evil, it's unjust, it's inhuman, and because it can destroy everybody. There are those who say to me, you should stick to civil rights and don't mix these issues. And I always have to say that it would be rather absurd for me to be working for integrated housing and integrated schools and not be concerned about the survival of a world in which to integrate. And I think we've got to see that the question now is the survival of mankind. John Fitzgerald Kennedy said on one occasion, mankind must put an end to war. A war will put an end to mankind. This is where we are today. And so let us continue to stand up for peace, and let us continue to stand up for freedom and justice. Let me say in conclusion that even though our struggle is much more difficult now, and it's more difficult because it's going to cost something. It's going to cost billions of dollars. As I said earlier today, it's easier to integrate a lunch counter than it is to eradicate slums. It's easier to guarantee the right to vote than it is to guarantee a guaranteed annual income or to create jobs. And so things are more difficult now. And I must honestly confess that I go through those moments of disappointment when I have to recognize the fact that there aren't enough white persons in our country who are willing to cherish democratic principles over privilege. But I'm grateful to God that some are left. And I say to you that our goal is freedom. I believe we're going to get there, however difficult it is. And I believe we're going to get there because however much she strays away from it, the goal of America is freedom. And our destiny is tied up with the destiny of America. Abused and scorned though we may be as a people, our destinies are tied together. Before the Pilgrim Fathers landed at Plymouth, we were here. Before Jefferson etched across the pages of history the majestic words of the Declaration of Independence, we were here. Before the beautiful words of the Star-Spangled Banner were written, we were here. And for more than two centuries, our forebears labored here without wages. They made cotton king. They built the homes of their masters in the midst of the most humiliating and exploitative conditions, and yet out of a bottomless vitality, they continued to grow and develop. And if the inexpressible cruelties of slavery couldn't stop us, the opposition that we now face, including the so-called white backlash, will surely fail. We're going to win our freedom.
Redemption song. All pirates, yes, they're rabbi, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit, but my hand was made strong by the end of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing another song of freedom? Is all I ever have. Redemption songs, children. Redemption songs. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. Have no fear for atomic energy. None of them can stop the tank. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it. We've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help to sing another song of freedom? It's all I. Redemption songs, redemption songs, sing all we miss children in every way now.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio in New York City, WBAI at 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction. fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name's Jim Freund. With me this morning, WBAI alumnus Ken Gale, and we're going to talk baseball and genre. But first, something about comics.
Hour of the Wolf movie review, air date April 10th, 2014, Captain America, The Winter Soldier, take five. Yes, five. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. So, Captain America, The Winter Soldier, that's what we're talking about. Let me say one thing first of all. I'm not deeply steeped in the Marvel Universe, so I'm one of those guys who thought the Winter Soldier referred to Captain America, a.k.a. Steve Rogers himself, not another character who is actually Cap's adversary in this film. Somebody in Marvel Studios marketing needs to learn that the thing to the right of the colon is supposed to modify the thing to the left of the colon. It's not a separate thing. We've got another symbol when you want to put two things together. It's called an ampersand. Or a plus sign if you're Baz Luhrmann, but that's a specialized case. Anyway, let's not get mired in trivialities. Even though that's essentially what we're about to do. What do you want from your superhero movie? Big action? Yep. You want a hero with the powers of a demigod and a moral compass that'll steer him straight and true, and an antagonist powerful enough to be his equal match. And this being the Marvel Universe, you want at least a feint towards deeper themes. Well, congratulations, if you go to Captain America, The Winter Soldier, you'll be getting all that. Or perhaps I should phrase it as, that's all you'll be getting. It's a good film, but a serviceable one, following the roadmap of the Marvel franchises, but not bothering to blaze any trails on its own. Let me point out, I'm not ungrateful for that. You spend enough time watching enough crap. You're grateful when a film gives you 2 hours and 20 minutes of fun, as sibling directors Anthony and Joe Russo deliver here. The original Captain America film, Captain America: The First Avenger, was able to rise above the other Marvel films that were then setting the table for Joss Whedon's The Avengers by being a period piece set during World War II and pitting Cap against his classic foe, the Red Skull. The time period and the conflict gave the film a unique feel which director Joe Johnston made good use of. Winter Soldier, by comparison, is set in the present day and runs over some well-trod plot elements, with Steve Rogers in flight from his former allies at the secret organization S.H.I.E.L.D. after he's framed for the assassination of an important member of the organization. There are a few surprises and revelations here, although I suppose the more you're familiar with the Marvel Universe, the less likely you are to be surprised by them. Even if you're not one of the true believers, though, so much of the supposed surprises and reversals are part of the stock action film playbook that you won't have much trouble calling the beats way before they crop up. By the way, in addition to Captain America, you're also getting Scarlett Johansson's Black Widow here, and there's good chemistry between her and Chris Evans, who's once again playing Steve Rogers. And Robert Redford is in there and does a good job with his role, and Samuel L. Jackson gets well-deserved screen time returning as Nick Fury, but I know I already had you at Samuel L. Jackson. There are a couple of interesting wrinkles that help elevate this above the off-the-rack action film. I'm not sure if in this we're seeing the guiding hand of Joss Whedon, who's now overseeing the Disney-owned side of the Marvel films. But continuing on from Iron Man 3, Winter Soldier also explores the idea of how fear can be used to manipulate a people, to steer them into the willing surrender of their liberties. Also, fortunately, the film doesn't dismiss Steve Rogers' history, finding ways of bringing his past back, particularly in a beautiful and creepily envisioned scene in an old computer facility that keeps you invested in the fate of these characters. None of this is really integrated into the story as well as it could be, but it goes far enough at least to keep the stakes compelling. By the way, talk about integrating things well. You may notice that in all this talk, I haven't really mentioned the Winter Soldier. You know, the guy on the right side of the colon. Yes, the character who's actually a superpowered assassin, tasked with making life difficult for Cap and his friends, is important in binding Steve to his past and raising our emotional investment in seeing Captain America triumph. But in terms of the scenario, he isn't all that much. He shows up, he blows stuff up and kills people, and he's the big bad for the final throwdown. But his involvement in the plot isn't much more than that. Better than Boba Fett, but ain't no Loki, that's for sure. So there you have it. Captain America the Winter Soldier is a good enough comic book action film, and good enough is good enough if that's what you're looking for. We've got three more Marvel movies coming up this year. If they're all at the level of this, that'll be fine. I can live with that. But I do hope at least one of them exceeds baseline expectations. I've got a potential candidate picked out, but out of respect for all of the films and the people who worked on them, I won't say which. Ball's in your court, Mr. Singer. I'm Dan Persons. If you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, please check out Cinefantastique Online at cfqonline.com.
Next at the plate for the Yankees, Hank Bauer. On deck, Mickey Mantle.
When we met in 1938, it was November. When I said that I would be his mate, it was December. I reasoned he would be the greatest husband that a girl had ever found. That's what I reasoned. That's what I reasoned. Then April rolled around.
Strike three, ball four, walk around, we'll tie the score. You're blind ump, you must be out of your mind ump.
6 months out of every year, I might as well be made of stone. 6 months out of every year when I'm with him, I'm alone. 6 months out of every year, he doesn't take me anywhere. 6 months out
of every year when I play cards. Solitaire. The other 6 months out of every year, we are hardly ever seen apart. But then the Washington Senators